An sa chléir seo se géisiir le Paci Manus Burns is ar de ré bhfuil te na hníon ar de réthe a scarpaí. Tá se nu a híon blianta ís agus tá scialtaí go leor le inseige, but níl ní cantar dúis géile cé agus a berla a merla bheits a chóra a scoma. Paci, I'd like you to tell of your youth where you were born and bred and where your people came from originally. So,
well, I was born in a place called Corker Moor, which is in Brookless Parish. I had nothing at all to do with Ardra, in spite of the fact that I was christened in Ardra because it was an Irish church, and it was the month of February. I don't remember it now, but and as far as I've been told, there was snow. So it was all walking in those days. So my Auntie Mary and a cousin of mine, Rose Byrne, and Patrick Gallagher carried me all the way about 7 miles or so from Corker Moor to Ardra. So because I was christened in Ardra, I reckon I'm an Ardra man. I wasn't born there, but I have a little grip on it anyway.
Tell me of how it was growing up in your youth, Paci.
Well, growing up in our area was, you had to be a genius to keep alive because there was nothing. Well, we would go weeks and weeks without any money at all. And but in spite of that, the whole thing was the best of fun. We had keelies or hoolies or whatever you like to call them nearly every night because there was nothing else to do in the long winter night. And our house was a rambling house. And the people would gather in, young and old, and my father would have plenty of tobacco and he would keep filling the pipe and the pipe would go round like an Indian celebration.
Yeah, just pass the pipe.
Pass the pipe around, and it didn't matter really whether you were a smoker or not, you would take a pull or two out of the pipe because my father would be watching, and if you weren't smoking, he might think, this is what people thought in their own minds, that he could get a disease off the pipe. So for friendship's sake, everyone, the men in particular, took a pull out of the pipe.
But like you lived in a mountain region, Paci, is that true? The area you lived in, it was a mountainy region?
Oh, it was. Well, now, our area wasn't really high mountain caps, but it was a mountain of bog. It was boggy land, bogs and rocks, with an occasional little bit of land in between the bogs and the rocks that you could grow crops on and cut some hay of it. But it was a kind of, to look at it from a distance, it was a wilderness, all brown, faded heather. Then when you came into it, you saw little patches of green here and there. You could just call it bad land.
But your father, he grew your crops, your own food.
Oh, goodness, yeah. Yes. He was out, I remember him waiting for daylight to go out to work in the field because he would work there till about 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon and then he would fill a load of turf on the horse cart and start away for St. John's Point or Dunkernilly or Brookless or somewhere and sell that. And that would be the first money for the week.
So he very much depended on weather and
Aye.
Crops of turf crops and
Oh, that was the only thing that would
that
do.
was
A
his only
few
earning.
cattle, but the thing is, you had no grass for cattle. The cattle didn't thrive on it. It wasn't good land. So having cattle was more of a nuisance than a novelty, because you had to work hard during the summer to get this wee grain of hay that would keep them alive in the winter. And there was no such thing as cotton cake or dairy nuts or anything, and they weren't invented in those days, of course. There was nothing, only grass and hay.
So he'd go as far away with the horse and cart, with the loads of turf, to Dunkaneely and surrounding areas.
He'd go up to 10 miles. he'd go from our house to Dunkaneely is about 7 miles, and from that to the lower end of the point is 6 miles. That'd be 13 miles he'd go, and 13 miles back again, 26 miles a day. Well, that'd be only maybe one day in the week or so. But it was, he could leave home on a good day and the spell of rain would come, and before he'd be many miles away from home, he'd be wet to skin, wet through. Every stitch of clothes would be soaking wet. And he was like that till he had these 26 miles done, and by the time he came back, the clothes were dried on him again. It was a hard life.
It was indeed.
It was a really hard life.
And Paddy, how many families lived in that area? Like, there was a group of houses or homes out there, you said?
Well, in Corcoramore alone, there was three areas in Corcoramore. There was one facing the east, and there was one facing the south, and there was one facing the west. There was none facing the north. Whatever happened, I don't know. The land wasn't formed in that shape. So we were on the east. We were facing the east. We always got the rising sun. And when we were youngsters, we had that to cast at the people on the west and the south side. They didn't get the sun as early as we did. And there was four houses facing the east, and there was three facing the south, and there was five facing the west. So there was 12 houses altogether in the Corcoramore area. Corcoramore is a mighty big townland, but it's just useless. It's wild and swamps. It's very dangerous for cattle or sheep or even for people walking on this land, because there's this little lochan, and you could just step into it. And they reckoned when we were young, they told us there was no bottom, that you kept going down, down, down. Well, of course, that was to keep us away from these lochans. But there were what was known as glare. That's, it was like tar, only not quite so adhesive or as sticky as tar. And sheep used to drop on, maybe reach in to drink and fall on, and that glare closed right over them.
And would just swallow them?
They were swallowed. They were nobody ever knew where they went.
No. Yeah. And Paddy, your people originally came from Wicklow, you said. There were a lot of burns out in that area you mentioned.
Aye, well, I don't know how many centuries ago it would be, but the Burns, some of them left Wicklow and came to Donegal, and some came to Mayo, and there's still Burns in Mayo. But the ones to Donegal, they came to Glen Cullum Kill. Now, why they came there, I don't know, because away back in those days, Glen Cullum Kill wasn't even a town. It was only just a little cluster of houses. And maybe they followed up fishing. Now, I don't know, because fishing was the only thing in those days in Glen. And in fact, in the whole area from Brookless back was all Killybegs and Teeling, and all that area was all, they lived on fish.
But your people came to Wicklow, they came from Scotland originally?
Oh aye, they came from, I heard, it was an old man, he was Sean McCumlach. Now, whatever that is in English, I don't know. McCumlach, he called himself. And I got to know him in London, and he was from, I think he was from Inishowen or somewhere away down that northern area. And he used to follow up people's ancestry. And he got friendly with me anyway, and we got to talk one day, and he said, do you know, he said, I'll follow up the Burns and to see where they came from. So he came up with this anyway, that they were originally from a place in Scotland called Kinlochleven. And he told me, like, how long ago it was. It must be maybe 16th or 17th century. But, oh, he had it all off right. And then about us, about our people moving to Wicklow and settled in a place called Inniskerry. And then got tired of that place, I suppose, and headed for Donegal, for Glen Cullum Kill. Mm-hmm.
And they were originally, you said, called Burn, B-U-R-N.
Aye, aye, and the Scottish people, when they came over, they changed their name to Burn. And in fact, by all rights, I should be Burns.
Burns,
because
yeah,
that's what the name was in the, oh, I don't know, maybe 16th century. But I never called myself Burns.
No. Paddy, we just go back again to your youth and where you were brought up. Your dad, you said he was a matchmaker.
He used to do that. He, well, he was a kind of a compulsive talker.
What was your dad's name anyway?
Connell.
Connell.
They called him Con for short.
Right.
Con Burn. And he would hear of somebody wanting a woman. And wanting a wife, of course. So he used to be at fairs and cattle markets and all that, and he was talking to everyone. And he would spread this news anyway amongst a few of his cronies that Paddy so-and-so would like to get married. Would you know of a suitable woman? So they would know of a suitable woman, maybe some relation of their own that they were dying to get rid of. And, well, we'll make an arrangement and we'll go to visit this woman. So my father would get Paddy so-and-so, whatever his name was, and away they would go with a bottle of whiskey out over the mountain or out over the hills and get to the house, of course, and have a look at this woman. And you know something, it was really making an animal of the woman. She would be vetted, almost vetted. And if the man thought she was all right, fair enough, there was a wedding. And the strange thing about it, that they all turned out good. They all turned out, they brought up some of them, big families, in fact, in those days. 9 and 10 youngsters was an average family. But my father would have a hand in that, of course, and well, he was getting a drink of whiskey out of it.
That was the deal.
He was also doing Paddy a favour, and so he did. And then his own marriage then was very ordinary. He was courting my mother for, oh, maybe a couple of years before they got married. So he was useful in a way, but he would be laughed at nowadays.
Well, at the time it was the done thing.
At the time it was the only way, because this poor Paddy fella, or whatever his name would be, hadn't a hope of getting a woman in his own area. He would have thought this woman would have to come from some distance. So the
fairs were useful like that as well, like, and your father wouldn't meet up with people.
The fairs and the markets, aye. They were innocent people in those days, but they were damn clever. They were very bright people. They could think far ahead. Because, you know, nowadays, and even in my time, people didn't think. People don't think no more, because they don't have to. Everything they want is at hand. But in the old days, you had to be a thinker to survive. And plan, you had to plan your life maybe a month ahead. Otherwise, you would have nothing to eat or nothing to... No. If your shoes wore out, if you hadn't planned for something to put away a bit of money a month before, that you'd want the shoes.
It was tough.
Your
bringing up was tough.
It was.
Your mum and dad had no income, like regarding social welfare.
There was no word of social welfare.
You had to survive.
Had to survive on your wits and on your hard work. My mother used to go out with a spade and dig spuds, and she was like a man.
She did as much work as any man.
Out in the fields, she did. And she could build a stack of turf as good as any man you ever seen. And work at hay.
But you were never hungry still, Paddy?
Never.
No.
Never hungry.
You grew your own.
Because, well, I suppose every woman was the same in those days. They all knew how to handle the wee bit of food they had, that it went the right distance. And, well, my mother, she would make a dinner out of a doormat, because she had the gift of cooking. And everything was home-produced. There'd be no shop food at all brought in. I never remember any shopping coming into our house. My mother, well, she would, a bag of flour, and that would do about 4 or maybe 6 months. And some Indian meal to make Indian porridge. And that's about all that was bought. The eggs were there, the milk was there. She made the butter, she made the bread, and that's all we asked to live on.
I suppose you had oil lamps though, Paddy, did you? In those days you wouldn't have had electricity, so you'd be using
oil lamps. There was no electricity, no. Oh, I remember the electricity coming into our area. And some of them, a couple of them refused to have it because it was the work of the devil.
They thought?
Aye, they thought it was. You know, in spite of having nothing and living a sort of a precarious lifetime, there were very religious people in those days. And they did believe that, now if you told them that you could talk to somebody in England or far away as Japan on the phone, that you could see this happening, they would say that some spirit caught your voice and carried it to Japan and gave it to whoever you wanted to talk to. They had that strange kind of a thing. Well, along with everything else, I suppose you could blame religion for it, because they were really held down quite a lot.
Describe the house you lived in, your home, Paddy. How was it to live in? Was it cosy and you had your own turf and all that?
Oh, it was cosy. We had a little thatched house and it was warm as could be. And that house would be well looked after. My father used to grow corn. Then he would thresh the corn and the grain went to feed the horse and put a bag or two away for seed the following spring.
Next year, yeah.
And there wouldn't really be very much point in storing up anything because you couldn't sell it because nobody had money to buy it. The only thing, my father was done barter, he done swapping. He would swap maybe a stack of turf for a calf. Somebody wanted to sell a calf and he wanted to sell a stack of turf. He would have a swap, no money.
No money exchange.
No money at all, just a swap. That went on and everybody knew everybody. And everyone was on first name terms. And if you finish your own little job and you saw that some neighbour was struggling to get finished before it would get dark, you went and gave him a hand.
Yeah.
Oh, that was a known thing.
Mm-hmm. So when did you leave then? You emigrated to Scotland, was it, or to England first?
England.
Tell me about that, Paddy.
Well, the thing about it is it was the only alternative. It was all we had because there was no point in staying at home. You could work on the land, but you never had anything. So all the young men in particular, and a lot of the women too, emigrated. England, Scotland, America. America was just beginning to boom at the time and there was a bit of a stampede into America. So I left when I was 19, in 1936. And I went to Kettering in Northamptonshire. I got a job in the steelworks in Corby, at Stuart & Lloyd's, and it was hard work, And I was a bit lazy, I suppose, and I thought, now there's bound to be something nicer than this. So I left it, and I went away to Leicestershire, to Market Harbour, went on the railway, and had a lovely job on the railway.
What were your duties on the railway, Packing?
Driving horses. Now, you're not going to believe that, because nobody does believe me when I say that I was working horses on the actual railway line.
Drawn a carriage or something?
Drawn in wagons.
All right.
Shunting with horses instead of an engine. Aye. Hook the horse to the wagon and draw it into the yard. Draw out the empty ones. And that's what I was doing. I also was delivering foodstuffs and things, that nearly everything came in by rail in those days, because there weren't that many mechanically propelled road vehicles. So I was one of the carters. I used to deliver stuff around the towns.
With the horse?
With the horse.
A pair of horses or one?
No, well, for if there's anything very heavy, like scrap iron or something, and before the war there was a bit of a trade on scrap iron, I would have two horses
right.
Side by side.
So you went out to shops delivering and all that, groceries and all that?
Oh, aye.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Then the war broke out, Packy, and tell me your memories of when the war broke out. Were you recruited, or?
Well, I wasn't recruited, really. I went to join up for the Navy, because something about it, I fancied the Navy. I don't know why, but I suppose I was young and foolish. And that was in 1940, and was turned down, of course, because I had tuberculosis. Now, that was the first I knew that I had tuberculosis, but they found it anyway. And that meant that I was no good in the actual services. So they gave me a job anyway as an internal security. So I was at that during the war. Now, that was a rather strange kind of an occupation, because I would go into a pub and just dodge around with maybe one half pint of beer, was all I could afford, and listen to people talking. And if they were talking anything against the British, I would have to report that to the police. I was working for the police. We called ourselves insects, because that's what we were, internal security, so we were insects. It's the kind of a thing that you would kind of, on those days, you didn't talk about it, what we were. Some were calling us spies, and others were saying we should have been chased out of the country and all, but it was worse on the like of me, because if I spoke to someone, they knew I was Irish. I had the Irish accent, and they wouldn't take too kindly maybe to that. I had narrow escapes, of course, but I always got out of it some way.
But yeah, you had no choice in the matter, Packy.
No, I had no choice in the matter, no.
No.
Well,
you were given that job because you didn't get into the Navy, and...
That's right.
Yeah.
And They were also looking for very well educated people to work in offices and in army billets and all this, but I wasn't well enough educated for that. Like living in Corcoramore, and the nearest school was 3 miles away. I didn't get a lot of education, and anyway, I had to pack up school at 13 to work on the land.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. But now, to tell the truth, the police were very, very good to us. You know, they never hassled us about anything. If you didn't fancy going somewhere, well, you just said you didn't fancy that, and right, you go somewhere else, and they would send somebody to the place that you were supposed to go. And I had worked all right, like we got our way paid, we got some food money, and we got a place to live, but we got no wages. No, we still had no money, in spite of being in England.
So the war finished then, Paddy. What did you do then, Nick?
Well, the war...
You worked on throughout the war, I presume, was that?
Aye, to 45.
Yeah.
The war then finished in 45, and I came home for a term. Then went back at the end of 46. And met up with an old girlfriend and got married. And that was a bit of a disaster too. She was a lovely woman and all, but she died 2.5 years after we were married with tuberculosis. And her mother died. Her name was Vera, this girl. Her mother died when Vera was only 9 years. And the father married again just to have someone to look after Vera, because she was a bit of a spoiled brat. And Vera and the stepmother never got along at all. So she left home and she came to live with me, which wasn't heard of in those days. That was a big sin. But we had a room in a house in Market Harbour. I went back to Market Harbour again. And after a while, we got married. So after 2.5 years, she had to go to hospital, or 2 years. And she died there. It was a very upside down kind of a life during the war. Like I used to come home once in a while. I would tell Sergeant Garrett that somebody was sick or something like that.
Just an excuse.
An excuse. Come home and buy a consignment of nylon, girls' nylon stockings, and take them back. And at that time, if you were caught smuggling, that was the end of you. You'd probably get locked up. But I used to carry a mandolin, and I carried the nylon stockings inside the mandolin. And they'd never think of looking inside a mandolin for anything you'd be smuggling. It wasn't a very deep one, and it just fitted nicely. The nylon stockings were in little packages. I think there was half dozen pairs in each packet or something. and they lay flat on the bed of the mandolin. That's how we smuggled in those days.
Did you make a wee fortune on selling them?
No, you would make no fortune, but you would make a little. Well, enough to keep you going, like.
So was it then you started your music thing and into the music scene?
Well, I was singing and playing music before ever I went to England. I suppose I would only be by 12 or 13 when I could play a mouth organ as good as anyone. And I was singing from I was about 5 or 6. I didn't do a lot at the music until in fact, I would think it would be 60s, the very early 60s, when I took it serious, took the music serious. Flack Hills started at the time, and I started going to Flack Hills, would come over from England to the Flack Hills in Ireland here. And I started entering competitions, singing and flute and whistle playing and all this. And I never won anything on an instrument because I suppose I wasn't a good enough musician. But I did win a lot for the singing. I became the All-Ireland champion singer 62 and 63. So that kind of gave me an appetite for...
Right, Paddy, we're off again. So you were successful at the Flack Hills, Paddy, and that started you off on the music then. Encouragement?
Well, I did get encouragement to tell the truth now, but you see, for a long time I wasn't even fit to sing. I still cannot sing, not a note, but I was 3.5 years with tuberculosis and done no singing at all during that time. Until about 2 weeks or so before I got out of hospital. I must tell you this. This fella, he was Dr. Cassidy. He was a Dublin man. And he was in the hospital in Maryland Park in Galway. And he came around one day and it was pulling up to Christmas. And he said, I want you, he said, get out of that bed and start walking about because I want you to come and sing the Mass on Christmas morning. I can't remember what I said, but I don't think that I was fit for it. And he said, if I say you can, you can. God, I took him at his word anyway, and I did go up to the church on Christmas morning, and that started me singing again. That was in 1956. From 56. Oh, I was home then for a while. My brother was ill. I came home to give a hand with things. And when I went back, the folk clubs were going, and I got into the folk clubs and sort of graduated from that.
So you sang in pubs and clubs around the county back here?
Well, believe it or not, I never done anything in Ireland. Now this may seem strange, and I don't, to this day I don't know why it is that the Irish never wanted me. Even in the heart of London, the Irish clubs never would ask me to go and do anything. I suppose maybe they reckoned I was more British than Irish or something, because I went to England when I was young, and I was amongst the English all the time. And to this very day, you know, there are places that don't want to hear about me in Ireland. It seems funny. I don't know. I never done anything wrong as far as I know, but they still don't reckon that I would be the kind of a man that would want to have doing anything for them. But I'll live through it anyway. Hope so for the best.
It's mostly in England you play then, Paddy?
Aye. All England and Scotland and Wales. And, well, then, I've done quite a lot, nearly all over Europe.
Did you?
Aye. Well, Spain and France and Portugal, Denmark, Germany, Austria, and Switzerland, Italy.
You got bookings from all over, more or less, more all over Europe?
Well, the way of it is, we had what they called folk directories, and all the names, if you wanted to be in the folk directory, you gave your name, what you done, and roughly about when you would be available. Busy months like would be July, August and September, the holiday stations would have you that time. And this became a very popular book, this little folk directory. And people saw a name in the book. And in fact, I gave my surname, and I was pretty near the beginning of the book. The B's started off with A, B, C and so on, alphabetical order. And I got quite a lot of bookings that way. And then somebody would come to a club and they would see me there, and they would book me to their club. And it's sort of built up.
But were you always solo, or were you in a group? Or?
No, I never had a group. No, I was, for quite a few years I was solo, and then I met a girl from California, a harp player, and she kind of put me on the straight and narrow path, because I wasn't a very sensible character in those days, and she toned me down a bit. So we were together for 11 years, and then she left, and I thought, there's no point in me at my age carrying on my own. So I just packed up, and after a while then I came home, and I'm here ever since.
So Paddy, just tell me what kind of stuff you sang. Would it be Mostly English songs, or
predominantly English songs, and some Irish songs. The English audiences, they liked the funny, ridiculous Irish songs, and a whole lot of the sort of would call it Irish music hall. You know, the people in Ireland, there's no doubt about it, they have such a sense of humour that they can make jokes about themselves. Now, this is something I think it's about the only thing that the English are not very keen on, is making jokes against themselves.
But no, they never did.
No, but the Irish, if it means that there'll be a laugh, mm-hmm. if they can get a laugh out of it, the Irish will make jokes amongst themselves. Like, I wrote a whole book of, well, jokes about Irish people. It's called My Friend Flanagan. And the English bought that book, that they cleaned out the shops and kept reading these jokes over and over again, because they were Irish jokes. Now, I did put some English jokes in the book, but they didn't catch on at all.
Could you tell me some of the songs you sang, Paddy, like some of the English songs? Or?
Well, there would be mostly the English, in the English folk society, we'll call it. They went a lot for farming, English farming songs, and some of kind of love songs and that kind of stuff. And there wouldn't be the kind of songs that would catch on in Ireland, because there's no doubt about it, the Irish have the best songs in the world. I don't think there's anywhere in the world that you could get a small country like Ireland to have so many songs that tell a real story. Like the English and the American songs don't tell a story at all. At the end of the song, you don't know what it was about. But the Irish songs are a story put to music. And they really can put, some of them can come over very good, just like reading it out of a book.
Mm-hmm. Like a letter, just, yeah.
Paddy,
so you made a livelihood out of the folk scene?
No, I.
In the 60s into the 70s?
And into the 80s
even. Did you make a record, Paddy?
I did. I made
a few.
I made 5 LPs, that were called in those days. I used to call them portlids. And I'd done a whole lot of... Then there was cassettes before that. Then we got as far as CDs. And now they're at the... DVDs.
Yeah.
I wonder what'll be next.
Will we play some music, Paddy?
Well, aye.
Okay. Just take your time a second. Now, Paddy, I just forgot a wee bit there, but I'll just mention it here. You played with Sliabh Fáil, Leo Brennan, and his band for a while, Paddy.
Well, I never actually... I did play with them, but I was never one of the outfit. I used to go down to Gidor and stay overnight, of course. And if there was a local who lay going on.
You play well.
The sleep fire one day, and I was with them. That was, they were a lovely bunch, I'll say that. Leo himself's a gentleman, and Marie was great, Craig, and all of them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They were a great band at the time, but now, long before my time, but I've heard.
Before your time, yes. They were a good band now.
There's no doubt, and they were namely.
Mm-hmm. They travelled a long distance to play music.
They did, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Paddy, I'll just give you a few seconds now when we play some of your music. What stuff are you going to play again, Paddy? Just describe to me what you're going to play here.
Well, I'll try one CD called Brighton 5. And I think there's four songs that I sing on it, and there's still, along with that, there's some whistle playing. She didn't want any other instrument on, only just a whistle. I don't know why.
Okay, then, hold on.
At the sign of the bell on the road to Clonmel, Paddy Higgerty kept an itchy bean. Sold pigs meat and bread, kept a good lodge in bed, was well liked in the district he lived in. Himself and his wife both struggled through life, and on weekdays Pat mended the ditches. But on Sunday he dressed in a coat of the best, still his pride was his old leather breeches. For 21 years or so it appears, his father these breeches had run in. And the morning he died, up to his bedside, he called Paddy his own darling son in. Some advice then he gave before going to his grave, about how to take care of his riches. Says he, 'tis no use to step into me shoes, but I want you to wear me old breeches. Now the hard winter snow left the groceries so low that Paddy got it out completely. With the snow coming down, he could not get to town, thoughts of hunger him bothered him greatly. Then one night as he lay a-dreaming away about banshees, ghost spirits and witches, when a knock on the door brought him out to the floor, and he quickly pulled on his old breeches. Shouts Barney McGurk with a voice like a Turk, come Paddy and get us some eating. Says Big Willie Moore, we'll burst open the door, sure this is no night to be waiting. No sooner they spoke than the door it was broke, and the crowded round Paddy like leeches. And they swore by the bob if they didn't get grub, though it ate him clean out of his breeches. Poor Paddy in dread ran up to the bed that held Judy, his darling young wife, in. And there 'twas agreed that they should make a feed, so he slipped out and brought a big knife in. He cut out the waist of his breeches, the best. Then he ripped all the seams and the stitches. Then he cut them in stripes, just the way you do tripes. Then he boiled them, his own leather breeches. When the breeches were stewed, on a plate they were strewed, and the boys murmured, ah, God be thanked. But Paddy's young wife was in dread of her life, so she thought it high time for to shank it. You should see how they smiled, for they thought Paddy boiled some mutton or beef of the riches. But 'twas little they knew, it was leather burgoo that was made out of Paddy's old breeches. Says Darby McDuck, that's bitter and tough. Says McGinley, it's not much like mutton. And Mandy O'Rourke, on the point of his fork, held up a big ivory button. Says Paddy, what's that? Sure I thought it was fat. Murphy jumps to his feet and he screeches. Be the powers above, I was trying to shove me teeth through the slate of his breeches. Then they all flew at Pat, and to get out of that, he ran when he saw them all rising. Says Dolan, make haste, someone bring me a priest, be the holy St. Patrick I'm poisoned. But revenge for the joke, they all had when they broke the crockery, chairs, tables and dishes. And from that very night they'd knock out your daylight if you mentioned the old leather breeches.
A queer tale called Queer Bung Your Eye from Packy Byrne, but an English song, Packy, but not from an English man, is that right?
Well, that's right. Well, as is well known, like the Irish, they wander around in this country a lot, and one of their hobbies is picking up songs. And that happened to be one of the songs picked up somewhere in England many years ago, brought to Ireland, and either spoiled or improved, I don't know which. But anyway, it's been recorded by the Dubliners, in fact, with different music to it.
Now, you're wondering, you've wandered down to Brighton quite a bit. Have any idea how many times you've appeared in the clubs around this area?
Oh, I've no idea, but I'm coming down here for years.
Years and years,
yes.
One of the most popular entertainers in the local clubs, I'm
sure. Oh, thank you very much, I remember that, yes. I can't remember, I think it must be over 6 or 7 years since I first came down here. I'll still come down next year and the year after if I'm still alive.
You're not doing so much singing as you were now, are you?
Oh, no, well, hardly any, except just places like Brighton and Lewes and one or two other places in the north where I still want to go. No, I'm almost retired from the folk scene. I'm working for a living at last.
Well, I'm glad you're not cutting it out altogether.
No, I'll still do the clubs that I want to do. And have a very good excuse if somebody asks me to do a club I don't want to do. I can say, oh, I've packed up.
Right, well, that was a song. Let's hear your other side now, your music. What would you like to do for us now?
Well, I could play a whistle for you.
That would be lovely.
Yeah. And I'll play a tune called Blow the Bellows. It's a real tune and very, very fast.
Thank you.
It's about a young sinner I'm now going to speak, who once met a damsel in a famed London street. She carried a basket and rolled her dark eyes, saying, "Jack, do you fancy somewhere bonger? I laddy taddy whack for the little laddle and toddle I ay." "Bonger aye," said the sailor, "now what might that be?" "It's a new kind of liquor from far Germany, brought o'er by the natives and sold on the sly, and the nickname they gave it was a queer bonger. Aye, laddy taddy whack for the diddle addle and toddle aye." Jack gave her a guinea and thought nothing strange. "Hold the basket," said the damsel, "till I get your change, and treat all your comrades as they pass you by to a drop of good whiskey called the queer bonger. Aye, laddy daddy white for the diddle laddle and toddle aye." Jack waited an hour and then thought it strange, for the damsel she never came back with his change. He opened the basket, the kid let a cry, "Oh, me damn," but says Jack, "this is queer bonger. Aye, laddy taddy whack for the diddle oddle and toddle aye." To get the kid christened was Jack's next intent. To get the kid christened to a parson he went. Said the parson, "What name will the baby go by?" "Oh, be damned," but says Jack, "call it queer bonger. Aye, laddy taddy whack for the diddle oddle and toddle aye." "Bonger aye," said the parson, "now that's a strange name." "Well, it isn't," says Jack, "and the strange way it came. But instead of strong whiskey that I chanced to buy, wrapped up in the basket was a queer bonger. Aye, laddy taddy whack for the diddle oddle and toddle aye." So beware of the damsels you'll meet on the street. Beware of the damsels, although they look sweet. Look into the basket before that you buy, in case they might slip you a queer bonger. Aye, laddy taddy whack for the diddle oddle and toddle aye.
Lovely. Thanks very much, Paddy. Good to meet you, my good.